I don't know about you, Dan Mahar, but I feel as though this episode of the OHL podcast should have some sort of dimmer mood lighting. We should probably have a whiskey and a cigar with us because we're doing the late night recording following Game 7 of the East Final. Now the OHL championship is set. And of course, we want to be current when this comes out on Tuesday morning. I don't know about you. Are you a whiskey guy? Are you a cigar guy? You don't strike me as the whiskey and cigar type.
Not a cigar type, but I could do the whiskey thing, especially right now. Feels like a whiskey time.
So. It certainly does. Okay, let's get a couple of pieces of housekeeping out of the way right off the hop. Number one, hey, Jay from Barrie, thanks for checking in. We've now had a touch point in every Ontario Hockey League market. I'm sure there's more than Jay, but Barrie, for some reason, is just shy. We'll take it. Jay, thanks for checking in. The other thing, I have to eat some words from a week ago. Look, my memory is okay, but getting worse. And I don't know why the most recent stuff is the most difficult for me these days. And honestly, Dansky, I don't know where you were last week bailing me out of myself here, but you were no help whatsoever. I want to make it on you or put it on you, but it was all on me. London, as we talked about last week, established a franchise record with 10 straight victories to start the playoffs. And I thought, franchise record? I think this might be a league record. And so I had looked back because I wanted to go deeper back. I remembered 16-2 as being the best mark, first established, I do believe, by the Ottawa 67s. But I was looking further back, 20 plus years, to find the team that went 10-0 or better. I didn't find them. There were some 9-0s in there, including the 07-08 Kitchener Rangers. Lo and behold, the 2019, 5 little years ago, my Western Conference bias shows through. Apologies to Ottawa and all of our listeners there. The 67s went 14-0 to start the playoffs in 2019. My defense for not remembering is what I remember 2019 for, and the playoffs is the comeback kids from Guelph, right? They're down 3-0 to London in the second round, come back and win the series. They're down 3-1 to Saginaw in the third round. They come back and win the series. They're down 2-0 to Ottawa in the league championship. Those two wins making it 14 in a row for Ottawa, and then Guelph wins the next four to win the championship. That's what I remembered. I'm Western Conference biased. The Ottawa 67s, it's now on the record on this OHL podcast, 14-0 to start the playoffs in 2019. I will not forget again, I promise.
Sorry, Mike. I'm Morgan Riley. You're Mitch Marner. I thought he was your man.
Wow. Wow. Fair. A little bit painful still for this Leafs fan. But nonetheless, speaking of game seven losses, we saw the game seven tonight that just finished between Oshawa and North Bay. That marks, Dan, 5 straight seasons there has been a game seven in a conference final in the Ontario Hockey League. You go back to 2018, the Kitchener Rangers and Sault Ste. Marie Greyhounds played a game seven. Sue wins it in double overtime. The aforementioned comeback kids from Guelph in 2019, came back from 3-1 down, beat Saginaw in game seven. No playoff in 2020 or 21. In 2022, it was Windsor and Flint going seven before the Spitfires won it. And then last year, it was North Bay and Peterborough going seven, with Peterborough winning it, having to win game six on the road. And oh boy, no, North Bay had, they had to win game seven. No, that was game six on the road, right? No, game six was at home. That's right. I'm just trying to remember when Rob Wilson was telling us the way that he wanted to kind of mess with North Bay when they came in for game six. Anyway, back-to-back game sevens, East Final for the North Bay Battalion. 3 straight trips to the East Final, and they can't get over the hump. Let's start there with Oshawa blowing a 3-0 series lead. But in the end, does it matter? Because you won the series in seven.
I guess not. The goal is to get through, and they got through. But really, what a, I mean, kudos to both teams. What a series. It's so rare you see that 3-0 lead, come back to tie at 3, and then lose game seven. I mean, last time I remember it actually was their your Kitchener hosted Memorial Cup, Mike, when they played Belleville, right? They Kitchener jumped out to a 3-0 lead, gave the three back, and then won in game seven. Similar scenario. And for anyone watching, I think it's confusing, right? You see North Bay go in there last night, or at home, I should say, and smoke Oshawa 7-1, turn around the next night and lose 6-1. And I had a couple people ask me very recently tonight, how do you win 7-1 one night and lose 6-1 the next night? And it just comes back to my initial point. Scores do not matter. Do not take anything from the score of a hockey game. Take everything from the trends, the flow. It can happen, and we just saw it happen. But really, a lot of positive for both teams. I think North Bay just ran out of steam. You had an injury depleted lineup through much of the playoffs. Anthony Romanie never quite got healthy. Tried to come back, potted a goal when he did. Couldn't stay in the lineup. Dom DeVincentis, obviously, with the big injury there. So not to take anything away from Oshawa. Kudos to them for winning that. But what a series. It was just pure entertainment and a lot of grit and determination there.
Yeah, it was a great series. And I think your point on DeVincentis is well taken, but how do you take anything away from the performance that Mike McIver put in then for the North Bay Battalion throughout the playoffs, really, but particularly in the final, helping North Bay come back from 3-0 down, two overtime wins, then an absolute blowout, as you mentioned, in game six. And unfortunately, maybe that's just all the fight that this dog had in it, because it was a little bit lopsided in Oshawa's 6-1 series clinching victory on home ice. But I'm thinking now a little bit longer term, Dan, with this North Bay team. And we talked about them last week, five trips to the East Final in the past decade or so, but only one championship. And that came in that first year back up in North Bay in 2014. In 2015, they lose the East Final to, oh, Oshawa. And then they lost East Finals again to Hamilton when the Bulldogs were still in Hamilton. Then Peterborough last year. And with three straight trips to the conference final, you know that there are likely some leaner days ahead for the North Bay Battalion, because this core will, of course, no longer be together. And they're going to have to get back to the drawing board and see what they can put together for another run at championships in North Bay. But I just think, boy, the five trips and only the one title to show for it has it just got to leave you feeling like, wanting a little bit more, obviously.
For sure, you'd like to have more to show for those runs, but the glass half full scenario is how many teams get that many runs that close together? There's something to be said for the winning culture they built. I really do think that team had a lot of the tools it takes to get over the hump and win. There's some unfortunate luck this year, but you're right. I think they're going to pay the piper now when you look at assets given up to bolster lineup this year. A lot of players moving on after this season. It's hard to discount, though, the experience the young players get from runs like this. Unfortunately, I just don't think there's enough of them left in North Bay for next year. So you might have a lean year or two for sure. But building a winning culture and having five deep runs like that, the fans can't complain. No one can complain about it. It's hard to do. Winning championships is hard to do. So I certainly don't hold that against North Bay. But it's, yeah, I think the time always turns over in junior hockey. And I think it's about to in North Bay.
It's a great point. Winning the championship ultimately is not at all easy to do. We talked about this last week as well when we looked at London's tremendous success getting to the Final Four, winning Western Conference championships, but still only, in air quotes, as many championships over the past 25 years, OHL championships, that is, as the Guelph Storm, who have made it to fewer, but have a better winning percentage when they get there. So definitely difficult to do. And I'll go back to the trade deadline this year, Dan. I was one of those that was raising an eyebrow. I thought players like DeVincentis and Ty Nelson were going to be on the trade block this year to start the rebuilding process in North Bay. I thought maybe even Justin Ertl might be moved. And of course, Adam Dennis just shows he knows a whole hell of a lot more than me. And look at the impact that the additions made, right? The LeBlanc twins were terrific for them. Sandis Vilmanis came up big in these playoffs for North Bay. So they pushed all the right buttons to get to this point and to give this core one more kick at the can. They just come up one game really short in all of it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I can get inside Adam Dennis's head, but I think when you see a team deliver in the first half of the year, your plans kind of go out the window, right? And you feel an obligation to those kids to reward them for those efforts and say, you know, they're telling you, they're saying, hey, we're fighting every night for you here and we're getting results. Like, can you help us out here? We might just have another run in us. So I think sometimes GMs change course a little, and that's clearly what he did this year. And you can't fault him. I certainly don't look at it as a failure getting to the conference finals and coming within a game of getting to the league finals. So, I mean, that's a lot of extra revenue that they're churning out for all those home games. There's a lot of positives to be had from it, but yeah, you gotta imagine those are some tough internal conversations within a GM's own head when he's got to change course directly like that and have one plan to maybe recoup some assets and then change course and try and reward your current players. So we see it happen quite a bit. I mean, I think Kitchener did it this year too. So, yeah, you never know what junior hockey.
As far as the Oshawa Generals go, I think their season changed course when Callum Ritchie returned to the lineup in November. They've been really blowing a 3-0 series lead, notwithstanding. Again, really at the end of it, what matters is winning the series, which Oshawa did and now captures the Eastern Conference Championship. But they've been playing terrific hockey since November. They got the OHL Coach of the Year in Derek Laxdal. They've had great performances up and down the lineup from goaltending on out. And oh, yeah, by the way, by most accounts, this Generals team is about a year ahead of schedule. So I don't know, Dan. I don't know how you can talk about a team headed to the OHL final as complacent, especially when they must have had all the pressure on them coming into game seven, having surrendered that 3-0 lead. I don't know that you look at this as you're playing with house money because you were expected to be even better next year. This is a well-coached, hungry squad in Oshawa, and we've got the two number ones in Oshawa and London going at it in the OHL Championship now.
Yeah, you're right. You look at that team, they were supposed to be next year, right? And this wasn't a team that, I mean, they didn't sell out at the deadline. A couple really shrewd moves during the season to not pay an extreme price to get Connor Lockhart and Connor Punnett. So they did some shrewd things without mortgaging the future. So this is a team that should be set up really well for next year. The flip side of that is when you play this well and you have this much success, players kind of move on to the radar of other teams, pro teams, and examples I'm talking about are you look at a guy like Dylan Rubric, and as he earns a slot in the AHL next year, some of these players that could move up, but one that I have my eye on is, of course, draft eligible Beckett Seneca, who in this playoff run has vaulted himself onto the scene in the NHL draft. And I don't know if you saw, Mike, but Bob McKenzie released his projected top round of picks, and he interviewed a bunch of teams and noted there was a team that had Beckett Seneca in the top five in the NHL draft this year. So that's a guy that was thought to initially be kind of low first round, early second round at the start of the year, kind of moved comfortably into the 20 to 30 range for much of the year. But now we're talking top 5 to 10. So suddenly next year has some doubt when you play this well. And I'm not saying Beckett Seneca will not be back. I think he's got some growing to do in the OHL, but you have some question marks now.
And unfortunately for Beckett Seneca, he couldn't go for game seven. Connor Punnett's a little banged up. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out for the Oshawa Generals when they move on. I can't help but think when you talk about players, and this is my hometown bias, so forgive me, but getting elevated to the pros early. Mikhail Bodker, I remember that happening to the Kitchener Rangers a way back, and it just comes out of the blue sometimes. Heck, after watching Jeff Skinner score 50 goals, I was still surprised he went to the NHL as an 18-year-old. But nonetheless, it does happen. It has happened for a long time. And you're right. You get yourself onto the radar with the performances that the Oshawa Generals have been getting from so many guys, and it might change the look of the team next year. I'm sure they're not too worried about that yet. But let's look at the Western Conference side, the London Knights back-to-back now Wayne Gretzky trophies. Worth noting, by the way, Oshawa wins the Bobby Orr Trophy. Bobby Orr played for the Oshawa Generals in the Ontario Hockey League. Wore number two, didn't wear number four back then. London makes it back-to-back Western Conference championships, and the Wayne Gretzky Trophy is theirs again. They finished off the Saginaw Spirit in six, and dare I say the sixth game was the toughest of all for the London Knights to win, simply because, at least from where I'm sitting, they were shortest handed at any point in the series without Landon Sim, without Caleb Lawrence, without Sawyer Bolton in the lineup, all suspended. But Saginaw will get in the trenches with you anytime and play the kind of hockey you want to play. And London prevailed in what was a very heavy, awfully nasty Western Conference final.
Yeah, I think the order of the day is London will play any way you want to play, right? But they will impose their will on you one way or the other. And you have a team like Saginaw that can push back a little. Like you said, they can go in the trenches a bit too. They did it against the Sioux. So I think there was a bit of a war going on there. But all along, my only concern with Saginaw was you don't necessarily have that winning pedigree there. So you're trying to build it within. And they have a lot of razzle-dazzle on the back end. When you look at Zane Parekh, Jorian Donovan, Rodwin Dionisio, who I thought was fantastic all playoffs. But that's a lot of potency up front, like on the offensive side of the puck. How much were they going to be able to prevent goals when they really needed it? And it's not that they did a poor job, but you have a well-oiled machine like London coming at you every night. And that's why I predicted London in six for that series, because I just thought over the course of the series, London had ways to wear you down and pick apart those holes. And Saginaw just, the dam was solid, but it wasn't enough to hold for six games.
Once again, my curse prevails. Last year, I said Sarnia North Bay in the final. It was London Peterborough. And I said that, by the way, at the beginning of the playoffs last year. At the beginning of these playoffs this year, I said Saginaw and North Bay. I stuck with them until the very end. And of course, it comes out the exact opposite again. Note to yourselves, if you are one who lays the occasional wager, when I spout off at the beginning of next year's playoffs, just go the opposite and it might just work in your favor. But the Saginaw Spirit remain one of those. What did we have here? Four teams, I believe. Three teams without a conference championship. Sarnia and Kingston remain the others. And the other thing is, well, we'll get back to Saginaw in just a second. But I was thinking as we started talking about London and you talking, Dan, about them sort of imposing their will on you. Remind me again, but I seem to think back to the beginning of this season. We knew London was strong defensively. There was no question about that. Then they go out and add Michael Simpson, an OHL champion goaltender. But I'm pretty sure this was the season that we were coming into thinking that nobody really knew where the offense was going to be coming from for the London Knights. It was Max McHugh and a cast of unknowns, perhaps. And boy, oh boy, did they prove everybody wrong. I was at a game where they hung 10 on the opposition, so they could certainly score. Their penalty kill was incredible. Elite doesn't even, I think, begin to describe it. 28 shorthanded goals, 26 or 28. I'm pretty sure it was 28 they ended up with. Regardless, offense was not a problem for the London Knights. Defense was as sound as we thought it would be. And you put Michael Simpson in goal, and you've got the recipe for back-to-back Western Conference titles. It's simple as that.
Well, the biggest thing with London for me when I watch them is they have this remarkable knack to keep all their players focused and in the game. And it doesn't seem to matter what the scenario is. And like you said, who's out of the lineup. We had guys coming in and out of the lineup throughout the playoffs. Didn't seem to matter because they can go up and down that bench and have that focus. And something about what they instill in that team, and you talk about the penalty kill, well, I don't know what it is in Easton Cowan's brain when he senses these situations, but when they're shorthanded or the other team pulls the goalie, it's like Easton Cowan goes into beast mode. And I'm not sure I've seen anyone score as often shorthanded and on empty nets as that guy. So when you're in those scenarios, you might as well just keep the goalie in, because they're something different. Their focus is just always there, and they get to the net. They know they have that physical edge, or at least are even against any team. So they have no trouble driving the net. They know that's where the goals are. So you referenced a few players. They might not have the loftiest totals, but when you have everyone through the lineup putting up double digits and goals, then you can rely on that in the playoffs. It's hard to shut down when you're getting contributions from three lines, sometimes four. So yeah, there's a focus in that London game that I think just trumps everyone else, which is why I picked them to come out of there, and we'll pick them again in the finals.
the fans in Oshawa as the game was winding down against North Bay and well in hand, began the "We Want London" chant. So I will say here what I said on Twitter. I'm at Farwell underscore OHL, by the way. Dan is at his name, at Dan Mahar. I said on Twitter, be careful what you wish for, because London is and has proven itself to be more than ready for any opponent in these playoffs. Only two losses so far. On the Saginaw side of things, of course, they'll take the OHL final off, if you will, and then get set to open as hosts of the Memorial Cup in just under 3 weeks' time from the issue of this episode. But here's the thing, Dan. This marks 14, count them, 14 consecutive playoffs whereby the host team does not win its league. I know this opens up a can of worms that's been opened up many times before, but the last team to host the Memorial Cup and win its league was the 2008 Kitchener Rangers. And if you're trying to do the math, how can you get to 2024, only 14 playoffs? Of course, we lost two playoffs due to COVID in 2020 and 2021, but it's just not a great mark. And I looked back at all of those teams, Dan, and when you go back on it, as mentioned in 08, Kitchener, the last team to win the OHL, win the league it plays in, and then host the Memorial Cup, ultimately losing in the final to Spokane. Three hosts since 2009 have won the Memorial Cup. Remember, none of them won their league. And then those teams, by the way, Shawinigan in 2012, Windsor in 2017, St. John in 2022. Both St. John and Windsor were eliminated in the first round, and Shawinigan lost in the second round when they were hosts. So I still believe that we need to have a host team in this league in order to generate enough interest in market, but oy, it's just not a great look.
It isn't, and it's really hard to select the team that's going to win the league because you don't know that there's too many strong teams in these leagues anymore. So I think the goal is to get a team that isn't going to embarrass itself first, but to get a team that's going to be competitive. It's going to be legit. They might not be the league champion, but they're going to be in that realm. And I don't think anyone's arguing Saginaw's not that. So the teams that go out in the first round, that's problematic. Even the second round, I think third round and beyond, you've got a legit team. I don't think anyone's too concerned. You're right. They need a host team to draw the crowds, to even off the roster, or sorry, the schedule, so that you have the four-team balance. So there's a lot of reasons why you need to have the host team there. But I think the best they can do, Mike, is get a team that they know is going to be competitive. Hopefully a team that doesn't go out before the third round. And they achieved it. So I'm not too fussed about it this year.
I agree with that. And I'll go back to what you said earlier about how difficult it is to win the championship in this league and in so many others. But to bring out the crowd, you need that host team. I'm wondering, Dan, what the crowds are going to look like in Saginaw. We will get to that. Also, I've got a wackadoodle idea to throw at you when it comes to suspensions and how we deal with them in the Ontario Hockey League. Another team will not be bringing back its coach, and Canada's U18 entry is golden, plus our performer of the week. Lots still to come on this episode of the OHL podcast. Let's start with the attendance figure, Dan, since that's something that stood out to me, because I was watching the numbers and I noticed in the conference final versus the London Knights of all teams, great rivalry, two really good hockey teams, and the Saginaw Spirit were drawing their lowest home crowds of the entire playoffs in that conference final. And I'm really trying to wrap my head around why that would be. Have fans in Saginaw found other things to do? Is fishing season? I know fishing's big down there. Is it open and that's taking people away? I'm not sure. Did they just run out of gas as fans and maybe the market just doesn't have that kind of staying power? Overall, I ended up running the numbers for each of the teams that were into the Final Four. London, it won't surprise you, average attendance of 8,995, which is just a shade under its season average of 9,035, and that was the best in the league. Second most in that second round was the Oshawa Generals, with an average of 5,707 fans per home game. It's about 600 more than its 5,109 during the regular season. That was third best in the Ontario Hockey League, behind only London and Kitchener. North Bay shows up then. No, North Bay was fourth. Saginaw, despite that low Western Conference final, averaged 4,227 fans per game in the playoffs, which is about 600 over its regular season mark, where they were 12th in the league. And then North Bay, 18th in the league in the regular season. Only Owen Sound and Mississauga drew less in the regular season, but North Bay upped its numbers by about 1,000 per game in the playoffs, averaging 3,914 per. So that's a pretty nice number, and it's even more than the Western Conference final average in Saginaw, 3,650 average in the three games versus London, which for me just kind of stood out. And I'm really not, I don't have an answer for it, but if I'm being honest, it concerns me a wee bit. You're hosting the Memorial Cup. You made some renovations to make sure you could get 5,000 plus bums into the Dow Event Center. If you're not getting it for London Saginaw, are you going to get it for the Q and the Dub entry in the Memorial Cup? I'm not certain right now.
It is a very concerning number. It has to be. And those figures you rhymed off too, there's always some conditions there relative to drawing area population. And so, you know, a 3,000 attendance in Saginaw might be comparable to a 5 in Kitchener, or et cetera, et cetera. You know where I'm going with that. Having said that, it's still a concerning number. And I tried to anecdotally delve into it a little bit, just chatting with some people who I know had opinions on this and were fans of it. So one Saginaw fan I connected with said that the irregular home nights was a bit of an issue, that they weren't used to, you know, Mondays and Wednesdays. Fair enough. You still like to think that a conference final series against the London Knights would be enough to pull you out of your house on an irregular night. That's how the playoffs work. It's not going to be your Friday, Saturday, Sunday all the time. An interesting comment from someone else locally in the Kitchener market who did not pick up their playoff tickets for the London series, and I asked, why not? And their answer was interesting. And I don't know if this has anything to do with the Saginaw thing, but said that they just don't enjoy watching London play at all, because they felt London is dirty, goes after the players, and probably will win. And they had no interest in watching that. And I thought, well, it was kind of a mixture of saying London's kind of too good, they're sick of them winning, but also they don't like the style of play, didn't want to see their players getting hurt and the dirty stuff. And I thought, I don't know if that's a factor there as well, that maybe London is too much of I don't know what the word is, but they're not a draw because you don't want to see that. I don't know if that's a factor, but those were the only two excuses I heard. So I don't know what to pin it on, but it is a concerning number when you've got a Memorial Cup coming up, and you're right, you're going to have to draw on potentially irregular nights against a team you've never heard of, probably. It's concerning.
Interesting stuff that you picked up as far as this is concerned. And I want to be clear. I think it's a strong franchise for sure. I'm not going to claim to know a ton about the market overall. When you see 3,688 as the average attendance through the season, just below the midpoint, 12th in the Ontario Hockey League, look, that'll get you by for sure. I think the magic number is somewhere between 3,000 and 3,500 per game to keep yourself sustainable. So they've got enough, if not barely enough. But the building, admittedly, a wee bit on the tired side, although the upgrades have been really nice. And again, you're in Michigan. It's not like you're in a non-traditional hockey market. So it might also just go to show, like anywhere else, there's tons of competition for eyeballs, disposable income, which there is less and less of these days right now. And you got to put a great product on the ice, which I think Saginaw has done and has done for a number of years now. There's a reason they just extended both general manager Dave Drinkel and head coach Chris Lazary. So hopefully things work out, and I'm sure they'll find a way to put bums in seats when the Memorial Cup begins later this month. But a number that certainly stood out to us. Okay, the point that one fan that you spoke to made about the London Knights and not interested in watching a certain style of play that may end up with players on their team getting injured. Well, that did happen to a couple of Kitchener Rangers on hits in their second round series versus London that were suspended, suspendable hits. I think if I've got the numbers right, it's been 5 team suspensions to the London Knights. Sam O'Reilly and Caleb Lawrence in that second round. Then Lawrence again in the third round versus Saginaw. Sawyer Bolton and Landon Sim. So that's 5 team suspensions through how many games have the Knights played? 14 in the playoffs so far. And for Sawyer Bolton, going back into the regular season, that is his 7th suspension of the season. So here's my wackadoodle idea. And this is not an indictment of any of the players involved or even the team involved. I can read the hate mail coming in already, ohlpodcast@rogers.com. This is simply the numbers. The numbers are what they are. 7 suspensions in one season for one player. 5 team suspensions. I'm not the biggest basketball fan, but I know you get personal fouls and team fouls. Maybe if after a team accumulates so much in the way of suspensions through a season, and I don't know what that number might be, but there is an additional penalty added on. So let's say the number was 5. For every suspension afterwards, you get your suspension plus 2 more games. I was thinking about this more in terms of the individual with 7. I wonder if there would be any consideration to treating suspensions like we treat fighting. We have been clear in the Ontario Hockey League for sure. We want to reduce fighting. It went from a 10-fight limit to a 3-fight limit in an awful hurry. We've seen a rather dramatic reduction in the number of fights in the game with the threshold of 3. Every fight over 3, you get suspended for. Would that be a consideration for suspensions? If you get a 4th suspension, you serve that suspension plus, let's say, 2 games. If you get a 4th suspension, you serve, or a 5th suspension, pardon me, you serve that suspension plus 5 games. And then maybe a 6th suspension, it's that suspension plus 10 games. I don't know if there's any rhyme or reason to this. It's just something, Dan, that jumped out at me when I heard 7 suspensions for one player. That's a lot in a league that insists that player safety is of paramount concern.
And again, not to indict the particular player or team, but a player that plays about 2 to 3 minutes a night. So that's suspensions to minutes played is a pretty high ratio. And I think maybe the league is going to have to adapt here, because this has got to be fairly unprecedented, no? To have one player rack up 7 suspensions in one year. Clearly the league machinations were not calibrated to this, because it appears like they're dealing with each one of them every time as a one-off. And I believe if you really wanted to deter something, obviously you have to have progressive discipline, right? They're not changing their ways, so you have to tack on more each time until it stops. And for me, the surprising thing when you have any one player, I don't care who it is. I know in this case it's Sawyer Bolton. I don't care who it is. It could be anyone. It could be a player on the team we follow. But once a player has taken that many suspensions in a year, from a liability perspective, or you basically acknowledge this player is starting to become a danger to other players on the ice, but you didn't really take any action to deter it, really, certainly not with progressive discipline. So I bet you there's going to be a discussion this offseason saying, hey, like, one player taking 7 suspensions, we got to have some sort of mechanism in place to deter this, because Sawyer Bolton or whoever, say it's Joe Smith next year, he takes his 7th suspension and it's on a play that injures someone severely, suddenly I'm thinking there might be some cases against the league and the team, and who knows, but you got to wonder.
Yeah. And that's where I'm coming from on this, Dan. Again, if player safety is of paramount concern, what kind of message are we sending when somebody is back out there to be suspended for a 5th, 6th, and 7th time, right? So I wonder if it will at least come up, if not be acted upon this offseason, because in fairness, it might be rash to act upon it immediately, because as you pointed out, this seems rather unprecedented, certainly in this modern, slightly tamer era of the game. And I want to be clear about this too. I like my coffee black. I like my whiskey neat. And I like my hockey physical. I like a big, heavy, banging and crashing game. I don't mind the fisticuffs in the game. I really don't. But I think there's a difference and a limit that we have to impose here so that things don't get carried away. And the biggest, one of the biggest challenges I see, and this was literally just an idea off the top of my head, but one of the biggest challenges I see with it is we all know what a fight looks like, right? You engage in the fight and that goes on your ticket for the year. Once you get up to your fourth fight, the suspensions start to kick in. Suspendable offenses can be subjective at times. We get that. Things are happening in real time on the ice in a really fast-paced game. My counter argument to my own argument that I just made is we are using video review more and more, and the league should have no problem reviewing each suspension or major penalty plus match, whatever it is, to determine that absolutely this is a suspension that counts against this player's ticket, much like the fights. I really think with technology, we can make this a pretty useful and suitable process.
Yeah, I think we need to, Mike. Like so if you were to equate it to a drunk driver gets in an accident 3, 4, 5 times and every time gets a 1 week license suspension and is back driving again, at what point when someone gets injured down the road is the legal system complicit? So I think the OHL has to look at it that way and just say, you know, these recurring things, we've at least got to escalate the punishment, find some way to deter it. So at least we've done due diligence to deter these things. So I wouldn't be surprised if those are off-season discussions, Mike, because I think this has got to be a first. I'd have to look back through the annals. I don't ever remember seeing anyone get suspended 7 times in the same season. So I think it's a bad look for the league. And it would be hard for them to explain if something serious happened on number 8.
Our podcast inbox was buzzing this week. Keep them coming anytime. OHLpodcast@rogers.com. Scott writes, absolutely love listening to the podcast. We appreciate that, Scott. Mm-hmm. A couple of questions or thoughts. At Budweiser Gardens, does the team in that venue really add crowd sound noise over the sound system, as previously discussed, to make it loud in there? No, Scott, I think we may have misled you or you misheard. What they do without question in London at Budweiser Gardens is crank the volume of the music up to about 12, maybe even 13. They're not the only rink to do it. And I admit I'm getting a little bit older. And so it's harder and harder for me to deal with the noise. But I don't think they're piping in any artificial crowd sound other than the artificial nature of the sound system getting so loud and encouraging fans on the video board to get louder. But every rink does that too. I don't know if you've ever noticed anything different, Dan.
Well, I just know if they did crank up the crowd noise, the players might not hear the whistle. So I'm sorry.
Well, it's interesting you say that, and I'll just let it hang in the air for everybody to absorb, because another one of Scott's questions, does the head coach from the team from the Forest City ever do any media/podcast interviews other than the OHL mandated press conferences? The answer to that one, Scott, would again be no, except with home media. And I say this with more than 20 years now in the league and always interviewing a member of the coaching staff from the other team every time Dale Hunter would send out one of his assistant coaches. And that's a head coach's prerogative. I've had other coaches do that on occasion, not all the time, but that is clearly Dale's preference. I do believe our newspaper reporter in Kitchener has been able to get some. I don't know if he's scrumming with the hometown reporter or not when that happens. But anyway, in all my years, I've never had a one-on-one with Dale Hunter before or after a game. So it just seems to be the way he wants to do things. All right. Let's go from Scott to Grandpa Bill, who I understand, Dan, that you know. So I'm going to go with the Grandpa Bill name here. And Grandpa Bill wants to know, because he doesn't follow the other leagues enough to get an educated opinion. So he wants to know the other teams in the Dub and the Q that are going to be likely in the Memorial Cup to play against Saginaw and either London or Oshawa. To which I would say, Grandpa Bill, I love you, but this is the OHL podcast. I don't know jack about the other leagues either.
I promise if, as we get narrowed down here, start keeping a more closer eye. I've seen some teams I like, Baie-Comeau, Saskatoon. There's some teams emerging, but until we get to the Memorial Cup, it's we don't need to care about that, right?
No, in fact, that's all part of my plan for junior hockey domination. Anybody, and I've got buddies in the leagues across this country because it's a great community to be a part of on the media side. Anybody that wants to pick up the torch of the WHL podcast and the QMJHL podcast, we'll make it a trifecta. We'll cover this country, all 20 teams, coast to coast. It'll be fantastic. Or all three leagues, all 60 teams, pardon me. But no, we don't, it's enough just keeping up with 68 Ontario Hockey League games plus playoffs. So sorry, Grandpa Bill, we can't help you there. And I love the email from Les to OHLpodcast@rogers.com, giving the pod some love from Flint. Love you back, Les. Appreciate that. Any updates on the commissioner search? Do they have the person identified, and are they just waiting until after the Memorial Cup, or are they still going through the process? That's a great question. I haven't heard anything in a while, but in fairness, I haven't been kicking the tires in a while. As I understand it, the announcement will be made in June after the Memorial Cup. David Branch will get the chance to be booed one last time in his tenure as commissioner. But I'd have to think, Dan, as we're into early May, so a month-ish, month to 6 weeks out from the announcement, if they haven't identified the candidate yet, I'd be pretty surprised. And if they've identified and named, they're doing a hell of a job of keeping the secret.
I'm with you, though. I have to think that if it's not a signed and delivered deal at this point, that it's darn close, and they just have some timing around not take they never want to distract from the playoffs and the teams that are getting coverage at this time of year, and then of course the big league events like the Memorial Cup. So I think they have a timing in their mind where this publicity will go forward. But like you said, they're doing a good job of keeping it secret.
They certainly are. Joe Burch's name was out there. He withdrew himself, as we've learned. Mike Fuda's name was out there. I've brought him up on the podcast in the past. Can't really tell you much more than that. And I'll keep kicking tires and seeing what might come out of them. But at this point, we're not hearing anymore. That's a great question, though. And that will obviously be a big piece of the off-season news. And I still think that the league has a real opportunity here. I know Barclay Branch is in the league offices, and I didn't love it. I said that before on this podcast. It's a little bit too cozy for my liking. Dad's the 40 plus year commissioner, and Barclay, without the same pedigree as perhaps some other candidates, ends up being the vice president very quickly, replacing Ted Baker when he announced his retirement. Didn't love it, but I will say again that I think Barclay Branch has done a pretty solid job in the role. So can't knock him in that regard. But anyway, that's just where the league office is at right now. I think there's a real opportunity for the league to kind of step out from that old boys club, if you will, from one branch to another, right? Commission VP, Conrad Hashay has been there a long time in that executive office as well. And so have others. And I'm not saying they're doing a bad job. Don't misunderstand, but this is the kind of time, especially in this game, that we've been looking for fresh ideas, fresh blood, and maybe the league will be thinking, and the Board of Governors will be thinking in that direction.
I hope you're right. I think it would be a great, like you said, whenever you have someone leaving after this long on the job, it screams opportunity. And I hope they did due diligence and looked at all the things you need from that position, because the list of candidates had to be long. But we've all seen with a variety of organizations who will remain nameless in society, but if you make the wrong call at the leadership levels, you're in for a world of hurt. So they've taken their time. Hopefully they've done exactly what you said.
Just bringing up Conrad Hashay's name as director of officiating has been for some time. It just makes me think back to that Saginaw London series. And I didn't love some of the narrative that came out of it. First of all, anybody that thinks that London, some way, somehow, gets preferential treatment, that's pretty hard to argue right now, given what I've already talked about, five team suspensions, 2-1 player, but still in these playoffs so far, ain't nobody else close to that. And 7 suspensions to 1 player. It's pretty hard to make the argument. One of the other arguments I didn't love hearing, and maybe I'm a little sensitive to this because I was a student at a high school where my father was the principal, but the narrative that was out there is that Saginaw was getting preferential treatment because Conrad Hache's son, Braden, plays for the Saginaw Spirit. I think that those people that are in positions of power in this league, whether you like them or not, whether you agree with all of their decisions or not, are plenty smart enough to keep arm's length and then some from things that would impact a member of their family. And remember, it's Barkley Branch, the VP, that's doling out the discipline, not Conrad Hache, the director of officiating. So I think that's worth noting as well. It just popped into my head when I mentioned his name.
Yeah, very. I'm with you, Mike. I'm glad you raised that because I hated hearing that too. And I know it's an easy leap for people to make when they understand the relationship between Braden Hache and Conrad. But and there was clearly a hit by Zane Parekh in the Sault Ste. Marie series that should have been suspended. Full on agree with that. That it was a vicious hit, should have been suspended. That does not, one thing does not equate to the other, to Saginaw getting preferential treatment. I'm with you on that one, Mike. I think that was a little bit of a false narrative, and I hate hearing that brought up because we can already probably find various examples to make a case that every team gets preferential treatment, but I don't believe that's the case here at all.
Last week, we talked about Chad Wiseman becoming the 6th coach fired in the Ontario Hockey League this season. What do we have? We had Ted Dent, we had Greg Walters, we had Luca Caputi, we had Ryan Kuwabara, we had Jared Smith, then Chad Wiseman in the offseason, and now Darren Rumble, although not fired in Owen Sound, but leaving to pursue opportunities closer to home, and Sean Tickle, his assistant, will not have his contract renewed. There is no doubt that it was a disappointing season, Dan, in Owen Sound, and it sounds as though general manager Dale DeGray wants a clean slate headed into 24-25.
And I think that's fair. I mean, I don't like to see anyone lose their job. I know these people dedicate a lot of time and energy, and they all put in a ton of effort. It's never a lack of effort. I think, obviously, in Owen Sound, the results were so far south of what the expectations were with the roster there that there was no doubt a change had to be made. And it probably wasn't the best scenario for Darren Rumble to walk into either, because I don't think they wanted to make the coaching change at the start of the year involving Greg Walters. So there was a lot of things going on there that added up to a really disappointing year, but I think it was pretty clear a change needed to be made there.
I really liked some of the things that Dale DeGray had to say in making this decision sort of for that fresh start, that clean slate. He says that the Owen Sound Attack have to get back to playing the way the city expects them to. It's a blue-collar city. He wants a blue-collar hockey club. If somebody scores 40 goals in a season or the team has the top power play, that's just a bonus. What he expects and what he believes the fans in Owen Sound expect is that players are going to compete, shift in, and shift out. He wants Owen Sound to be that tough place to play again. And we know as well as anybody, Dan, how difficult the Bayshore is as an arena to play in. But I loved one of DeGray's quotes saying that I want the bus for the other team to pull up and some players on that bus not wanting to get off because they know what they're in for when they try to take a point or two out of Owen Sound. So I appreciate that sentiment. That is clearly the direction that Dale DeGray is looking. And he's also made it clear that this is an international search, which I thought was interesting. Look, there are North American guys coaching in Europe that may want to come back to the Ontario Hockey League for sure. But when he said he's already had interest expressed from a coach overseas, it just makes me think of the trailblazing that the Kitchener Rangers did this past season. And I know not everybody loved it, but making Jussi Ahokas, of course, a native of Finland, the first European head coach in the Ontario Hockey League. So maybe, I mean, obviously, it's a desirable league to coach in, and Dale DeGray is casting the widest net possible.
As he should, and clearly with it being a global world now, if you can tap a pool that's much larger than you previously would have tapped, why not? But I completely agree with Dale DeGray's sentiments there about the type of team, because I was discombobulated this year watching how discombobulated those Owen Sound Attack were. I just did not recognize them. Typically, you go in there, they're a very tough team to play against. Doesn't matter who's on their roster. It's not a good building, easy building to go into. Lunch pail crew. I saw a team that lacked engagement, lacked almost lacked effort. Don't want to say they quit, but did not recognize them. So I think Dale DeGray saw what we saw, and he's got his eye on rejuvenating that.
One of the other things that he said was, if you had told him at the beginning of this season that his team was going to finish seventh, he would have laughed at you. One of the other things that this ties into is Carter George. And I think that when you have a goaltender like this, it provides you a real opportunity. I'm not sure if I mentioned it before, but Greg Cowan, the writer for the Owen Sound Sun-Times, said it and said it very well. I promise you, when I say this, I was thinking it. He referred to this as the Carter George window for the Owen Sound Attack because, again, having a goaltender of George's caliber presents a real opportunity for a team. So, what can the Attack do while Carter George is still their number one guy in goal? And I think that matters a heck of a lot because we know how important the position is. Well, Carter George and his U18 Canada teammates just put some gold medals around their necks. And I know I'm talking about Carter George, and you wanted to talk about somebody else, Dan, but we should give a nod to the U18 squad and their gold medal performance.
Oh, for sure. And I'm glad you started this by talking about Carter George because I'm not sure they win that gold medal without him. The American team was all over Canada in the finals. A few things swung Canada's way, but just what a backbone Carter George was. Maybe the save of the tournament, and you'll see it in the highlight reels. Ryerson Leenders is back. I mean, that roster was just littered with OHL talent. Keyshawn Aitchison and Cole Beaudoin from Barrie. You had Spence and Schaefer from Erie. You had Porter Martone. I mean, guys that aren't even eligible for the next draft. And you go down the list, Liam Greentree in this, just Muse, Morelli. I mean, the list was riddled with OHL talent. Jet Luchenko looked great. So much so that you have Marek Van Acker playing a limited role on that team. So it's just an incredible group of OHLers. And I think that, yeah, we'd definitely be remiss not to point out just how good they were. And that talent is all going to be back in this league next year. So, best ticket in town.
Doesn't Martone come away with some U18 scoring record for Canada as well?
Sorry, yes. Thanks for the reminder because I meant to mention that. Yeah. So, Porter Martone broke the Canadian tournament record for U18s, having played in it last year. So, his cumulative total over the 2 years is now broken the Canadian record. So, that's a pretty incredible record to hold for any kid. And, look out for his draft year, not till 2025.
Yeah, it's going to be wild to watch him in this league next year, along with Michael Misa, of course, the exceptional player that will play in his draft year coming up. And it's going to be a great season again in the Ontario Hockey League as we head into the championship this year. One more thing we wanted to touch on, because the draft is not too far in the rearview mirror, only about a month or so now. And when the draft was approaching, Dan, you and I were talking about players and options and the fierce competition that exists now. And not every player is looking at the Ontario Hockey League as perhaps their first option because the competition is so fierce and because other leagues are trying to eat a little bit of the OHL's lunch. Well, what an interesting story Colin Fitzgerald becomes. Selected third overall by Peterborough, but the Petes, maybe when making that selection, Dan, were taking a bit of a risk.
A big risk because Colin Fitzgerald had sent out a number of signals that he was not going to be reporting to the OHL. He actually signed a tender with the USHL. So all signs looked like he was not going to be reporting to the OHL. Peterborough gambled and took him with the third overall pick and sure enough locked him up. Peterborough kid playing hometown. Maybe there was some influence there getting to play close to home. But I think for all of the fear-mongering that was going on about what a disastrous year it was going to be for the OHL with so many high-end picks going elsewhere, some of them still are. A couple have tendered out in the BCHL, a couple USHL tenders still to come. But Brady Wasylin signed in Niagara. You get Colin Fitzgerald. So these guys in the top three signing is a coup for the OHL and a sign that maybe things aren't quite as bad as people had suggested.
I do wonder if for Windsor and or Sarnia, Fitzgerald's tender would have been a factor in whether or not they took a flyer on him. Peterborough does, I think, with good reason, because of course Fitzgerald is a Peterborough boy. He was actually an assistant equipment manager with the Peets back in the day. The family billeted Joe Van Volsen of the Peets back in the day, and he spent 8 years playing, Colin Fitzgerald did, with the minor Peets organization in Peterborough. So lots of things fall his way. And I guess the timing of the decision or the announcement was interesting, because I do believe that in making the decision when he did, the Green Bay Gamblers do not have to sacrifice the first round pick they gave up when they signed him to a tender. So all is well, if you will, in Green Bay, although they might feel a little bit like a spurned lover in all of this. But I guess it does go to show what level of influence a player does have over his destiny ultimately, right? If Colin Fitzgerald had not been selected by the team or a team that he was interested in, he was apparently willing to go the USHL route.
For sure. These players have so many options. And when you're a top three pick, you're going to have lots of options at your disposal. And why not play the field a little? And I'm sure there's teams in the USHL he had no interest in playing for, and there's probably a few in the OHL. So yeah, these players at the top end of the draft definitely have some leverage, but it also goes to show those tenders don't necessarily mean as much as you might think, because especially with the USHL draft being held on May 7th, this was just ahead of it. So sometimes things aren't worth the paper they're written on.
We have certainly been content rich on the pod this week. I think I have covered all of the bases on the notes I made, save for our performers of the week. Who you got this week, Dansky?
All right. Well, I know he has recently been eliminated, but I have to give a shout out this week to Ty Nelson. I felt that with the North Bay Battalion down and out, that guy pretty much willed his team back into it. A couple explosive offensive games, including his 4-point overtime winner in game 5 to make it 3-2. Just a terrific series, putting the team on his back. And don't forget, that's a player who routinely faced arguably the best line in the Ontario Hockey League right now with the Oshawa Generals, dominant top first line. So when you're playing both ends of the rink at an elite level, probably played his last game in the OHL, likely to move on to the HL next year. But yeah, my guy's Ty Nelson, Mike, just a phenomenal week for him.
I had a feeling, Dan, I really did. So I put Ty Nelson as my honorable mention instead. He was the guy I had. And then I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go recency bias here and go with the team that came out on top in game 7 that just finished before we recorded this episode. And I'm going with Callum Ritchie. 4 points in 4 games, but 11 points in the series versus North Bay, held pointless only one time out of the 7 games in the series. And I've said this many times, but the going gets a lot harder as the playoffs get deeper. And when you can put up performances like that, when it matters the most, certainly capture my attention. Second most points in the OHL when it comes to playoff scoring for Callum Ritchie, and he is my performer of the week.
He's just been terrific. Great call. And I think watching him play, Mike, every time I see him play, I wonder if the Guelph Storm and George Burnett sit back and wonder what might have been if Matthew Potter had been sent back. Because I feel that might have been a similar impact, just two high-end players, and drop them into a lineup and look what's happened in Oshawa.
It is the OHL's Red Tilson Award winner, Easton Cowan, and the London Knights getting set to take on the OHL Coach of the Year, Derek Laxdal, and his upstart Oshawa Generals, because we didn't think they'd arrive until next year. Just as we wrap this episode up, Dan, you want to throw a flyer out on who you have to represent the O in the Memorial Cup along with the hosts?
Yeah, well, I finally did well in round 3. So it took me 3 rounds to get warmed up. But I've got to stick with London, Mike. With all due respect to Derek Laxdal and his troops, I think they're a phenomenal team. I'm just not sure anyone's getting through that wall this year.
I had a strong start this year in round 1. I have been terrible ever since. But I'm with you on this one. I just don't know how, after what they have shown us again and again and again, from 50 wins in the regular season to 10 straight to open the playoffs, it's going to take an awful lot to beat the London Knights. I think Oshawa does have an awful lot, but it is going to be tough. I'll take the Knights in six in the final.
Yeah, same here. So no, we're going to have no bragging rights coming out of this one, Mike.
And remember, I've been terrible starting the playoffs, predicting the OHL championship opponents. So if you want to put some money on the opposite of me, you're welcome to do that. That guy over there is Dan Mahar. Find him on Twitter at his name, Dan Mahar. My name is Mike Farwell on Twitter at Farwell_OHL. Please do leave us a like, a review, follow the OHL podcast on YouTube. Tell a friend about it. We're having lots of fun doing it. We love having you along with us every single market in this league. And we will be back in 1 week's time as the OHL championship is well underway right here on the OHL podcast.
I'm Matt Kundle, host of the Sound Off podcast, the show about podcast and broadcast. Since 2016, we've been speaking with amazing people who have populated your ears for decades. Legendary broadcasters, research wizards, talent experts, podcasters, voice talent. Almost 400 stories, all for free. Subscribe or follow the Sound Off podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at soundoffpodcast.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.